It's September 25th, 2009, and we're broadcasting live, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And again, thanks to the list of fine affiliates that help broadcast and rebroadcast the show, ZeroPointRadio.com, RevereRadio.net, FROlympia.org, BoulderFreeRadio.com, BerkeleyLiberationRadio.net, and CascadiaPublicRadio.org. A disturbing story, what we can essentially call another dead microbiologist from WLS-TV, an ABC affiliate out of Chicago. Chicago family seeks answers in scientist's death by plague. A University of Chicago researcher died after being exposed to a strain of bacteria that causes plague. And Malcolm Cassadaman's family wants answers. That's C-A-S-A-D-A-B-A-N. Cassadaban. The Chicago Department of Public Health says there's no sign anyone else was exposed to the bacteria. The tragic irony is that Professor Cassadaban had been trying to develop a vaccine so that thousands of people around the world wouldn't die a painful, ugly death from a bacterial infection related to the plague. But it was just that bacterium that appears to have killed Malcolm Cassadaban.
A University of Chicago researcher dies after being exposed to a strain of bacteria that causes plague. And tonight, Malcolm Cassadaban's family wants answers. The Chicago Department of Public Health says there's no sign anyone else has been exposed to the bacteria.
ABC 7's Kevin Roy talked to the professor's family and joins us now with their story. Kevin.
Linda and Ron, the tragic irony here is that Professor Malcolm Cassadaban had been trying to develop a vaccine so that thousands of people around the world wouldn't die a painful, ugly death from a bacterial infection related to the plague. But it was that bacterium that appears to have killed him.
We really thought he was so strong. We didn't see this coming at all.
Not only did they not see it coming, but sisters Lee and Brooke Cassadaban say their father never knew what killed him.
It was just so much of a shock. Even the time that he was in the ER, from the moment he got accepted to the time he passed away, we had no idea. We didn't even get to say goodbye to him.
60-year-old Malcolm Cassadaban was a professor of molecular genetics at the University of Chicago for 30 years. The past 8 years, his daughters say he'd been working with a strain of bacteria called Yersinia pestis, trying to develop a stronger vaccine for the plague, once the world's worst health scourge. The weakened strain he was using, however, isn't supposed to make healthy people sick. And that is the big mystery now for investigators with the Centers for Disease Control and the state and city public health departments.
Was it a change in the organism? Was there something about the person who was infected that made him uniquely susceptible? We don't really know the answers to that yet.
It was hurtful just because we remember our father was very healthy.
Brooke and Lee Cassadaban say they're not satisfied with the answers they've been given so far. How did their father, who had flu-like symptoms, enter the hospital a week ago Sunday morning and die 12 hours later with no one suspecting that it could be related to the plague? Lee is following in her father's footsteps, now attending MIT, his alma mater, and says it may be up to her to solve this.
I plan to go to the lab to read his papers and to read his notes, and I plan to go and just try to really understand exactly what he was trying to do.
Lee and Brooks said they've been told that their father is the first person in the Chicago area to die from this bacterium, an infection that is usually cured with antibiotics. They say they're not eager to file a lawsuit, but Ron and Linda, they are wondering now if someone at the hospital or at the university should have been able to catch this before it was too late.
All right, thank you.
Now, my man Zach from here in Portland made the comment over on FBook, as you just heard them say, that Malcolm Cassadaban was the first person to die of this. Is that to mean there will be more? Google another dead microbiologist and you'll find postings on places like Democratic Underground and Rigorous Institution. There's a long, disturbing list of folks who work in biolabs who have dropped dead. And I can't help but be reminded of, I reference it many times, Goodfellas, that even after they've pulled off the big Lufthansa heist and the heat starts to get a little too hot, they start to whack their own guys. Because they know too much. Last thing I'll mention is that my man Richard Grove of TragedyAndHope.com left a little comment at the bottom of this posting thanking me for shedding some light on this story of the latest death of a microbiologist. This leads us into the latest BioWars and swine flu updates, planning the pandemic. We've got a list of headlines, but first let's set the table with a question from Paul Joseph Watson. Will Americans obey government orders during a swine flu pandemic? Local authorities are keen to know whether American citizens will obey the government in the event of an H1N1 pandemic and take the swine flu vaccine, of course, amidst growing fears of quarantines and forced injections that have been circulating in recent weeks. Every sign points to the fact that health authorities are preparing mass vaccination programs and quarantines that could be instituted should the H1N1 virus make a deadlier comeback, which has been all but guaranteed by U.S. health authorities as well as the World Health Organization. Part of those preps include gauging the potential reaction of Americans to unpopular orders dictated by an increasingly distrusted government. How many citizens will follow orders to stay indoors, evacuate, or take a shot? Some of those questions form part of a survey being conducted by the University of Virginia's Health Department targeting everyone except federal government agencies and their employees, who are not qualified respondents for the survey target population, according to an advisory sent with the survey, which we, of course, all have linked up for you. The survey was forwarded to the InfoWars team by a reader who is part of a CEO-only networking group called Mindshare in Washington, D.C. I could only find some other organization called Mindshare. I couldn't find any info about this CEO-only networking group called Mindshare. I was sent the survey below that is probing folks in Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. on what they would do in a pandemic or anthrax situation, writes Etienne de la Botie. They appear to be trying to determine if folks will comply with government directives in either a flu pandemic or anthrax attack. The survey, entitled Community Shielding Shared Spectrum, was issued by the Critical Incident Analysis Group at the University of Virginia. And again, it's all linked up. You can read the survey, post it up by way of surveymonkey.com, and more on CIAG on healthsystem.virginia.edu. Will Americans obey government orders during a swine flu pandemic? However, in other BioWars news, pandemic flu vaccine production to fall short, that's from the Washington Times, and disturbingly, but we've already covered many reports of mass graves and even mortician unions prepping for possible large body counts. By way of CTV.ca, Canada prepares for an H1N1 pandemic with body bags.
The specter of death from swine flu has become part of Canada's readiness plan. In a stunning development, Health Canada shipped body bags to at least two First Nations communities in Manitoba. The leaders there are shocked by the decision and offended on more than one level. CBC's Lindsay Duncombe reports from Winnipeg.
For months, chiefs from northern Manitoba have been waiting for supplies from Health Canada to help fight the swine flu. They didn't ask for these.
We feel rejected. We're abandoned as an isolated community.
The chief says body bags, 30 of them, were delivered to Wasagamac, possibly along with antivirals and hand sanitizer. At least two communities in northern Manitoba received body bag shipments, Wasagamac and God's River First Nation. Chiefs in other remote communities hit hard by swine flu in the spring are now going to their nursing stations to see if their communities received body bags. The grand chief of the area says it's culturally insensitive.
When you prepare them, obviously you're inviting them to come to your community. because we do not ever prepare for such matters.
This is just the latest in a series of conflicts between Manitoba's remote First Nations and Health Canada over swine flu. Chief Harper came to Winnipeg to stock up on hand sanitizer during the outbreak. It was later revealed the government delayed sending the product to First Nations because of its alcohol content and concern people would drink it.
Health Canada couldn't say how many communities received body bags, whether or not this is happening across the country, or if it's part of the pandemic plan. We asked the province of Manitoba if it happens to be stockpiling body bags for fears of swine flu deaths. It's not.
The federal health minister says the shipments are disturbing. She's ordered an immediate investigation.
This is a serious issue. It's very concerning to me, and once I know more of it, I will be able to provide you with information.
Both the NDP and the Liberals were quick to criticize.
But sending in body bags in the event of death is to say, look, we're not going to be able to help you, our hands are tied.
No one was at the Health Canada building in Winnipeg when Chief Jerry Knott got there to return the bags. He left them on the doorstep.
Return to sender.
Lindsay Duckholm, CBC News, Winnipeg.
Now, if we jump to globalresearch.ca, a massive new article from Michelle Chosadovsky, Planning the Pandemic, Body Bags, Mass Graves, and Quarantine Orders. Just a little bit of selected evidence where he does go over the body bags in Canada that we just hit. Mass graves and increased mortuary capacity in the UK, with charts and graphs and scans from actual documentation. We've got the CDC's quarantine stations by way of U.S. Homeland Security. Iowa and their facility quarantine order. Massachusetts and their $1,000 a day fines. Forced vaccinations in Massachusetts. You can check out the Massachusetts Senate bill, PDF form from mass.gov. And on and on and on. Planning the pandemic. One of the Native Americans in that clip just said, you may not have heard it, got a little garbled there, that when you plan for this kind of death, you're inviting this kind of death. By way of The Guardian, swine flu could kill millions, says leaked United Nations report. The swine flu pandemic could kill millions and cause anarchy in the world's poorest nations unless £900 million UK can be raised from rich countries to pay for vaccines and antiviral medicines, says a UN report leaked to The Observer, which is connected to The Guardian. The disclosure will provoke concerns that health officials will not be able to stem the growth of the worldwide H1N1 pandemic in developing countries. If the virus takes hold in the poorest nations, millions could die and the economies of fragile countries could be destroyed. Health ministers around the globe were sent the warning on Thursday in a report on the costs of averting a humanitarian disaster in the next few months. State says stored, or rather forced, injections and quarantines for a rapidly spreading germ, but not swine flu. Another fascinating and cutting article from Paul Joseph Watson. Health authorities in Massachusetts, again, Massachusetts, have indicated that they will impose quarantines and mandatory vaccinations in the event of an H1N1 virus mutating into a lethal germ, but that forcible injections are not on the agenda for the swine flu outbreak as it stands. So whether it's swine flu or not, we got you. An interesting note from FederalJack.com, pandemic charges filed with the FBI in New York City. Dr. Lynn Horowitz and some other folks have essentially sent an affidavit of evidence regarding the private global biotechnology trust that is behind this and most pandemics. Verichip shares jump after their H1N1 patent license win. That's from Reuters. From the Orlando Sentinel. A little sports note for you sports fans out there. What did the Florida Gators put up their nose to combat influenza? The Sentinel's Jeremy Fowler reported Sunday that UF football players received a nasal spray vaccine over the weekend for a seasonal flu virus. So what exactly did the number one Gators spray up their nose? Well, the CDC says the nasal spray flu vaccine is a vaccine made with live weakened flu viruses that do not cause the flu. Of course not. China begins mass vaccinations for swine flu. That's from the AFP. Novartis microchip to help ensure bitter pills are swallowed. This from the Financial Times, FT.com, essentially one of the big mouthpieces of the elite. Your old grandparents who maybe have Alzheimer's or some dementia that we referred to on the previous episode, 141B, a microchip can be implanted to remind you when to take your pill. Daycare worker told she'll be fired for refusing mandatory flu shot. And then even more updates. Panel sees mounting bioterror risk. That's from govexec.com. Volunteers help out when first responders can't. That's from the SoharitaSun.com. And that, of course, details the fact that many folks in the public and private sector have essentially been deputized to be able to give you the shot. NationalPost.com shows that Canadians are willing to suspend liberties in a pandemic. They've got the poll numbers to prove it. Mom says swine flu contributed to her teen son's death. That's from WOAI.com. Hospitals make flu shots mandatory from KWQC.com. Nurses plan rally to protest mandatory swine flu shot. I believe that is in the UK, but back here in the States, mandatory swine flu shots for firefighters. Firefighters could be added to the list of those mandated to take the dangerous and untested H1N1 vaccine if Parkersburg Fire Department Chief Eric Chichester gets his way, while health workers in Ontario, Canada, have been told they will not be forced to take the shot. Firefighters do not work in hospitals, but because they are trained EMTs, Chichester believes they should both get the seasonal and H1N1 vaccines. I plan on getting vaccinated as soon as it's available, he said. Our guys have the choice of getting the regular flu shot, but I'm looking into ways I can make it mandatory for them to receive the H1N1 vaccine, he told the News and Sentinel, newsandsentinel.com. BioWars and swine flu updates. They are planning the pandemic. Now, we referenced Sprint earlier on the list of 10 big companies teetering toward bankruptcy, but a nice little press release from Sprint.com. Sprint provides cell and GPS service to FEMA for their vehicle tracking program. This vehicle tracking program is officially called, if you'd like to Google it, and I've already supplied the link for you to run the search and find out more, Commercial Equipment Direct Assistant Program. CDAP. So, the press release from Sprint. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, a division of the Department of Homeland Security, is relying on Sprint to provide 2,000 Nextel handsets in support of FEMA's nationwide vehicle tracking system. As part of an agreement signed earlier this year, Sprint is providing handsets equipped with industry-leading Nextel Direct Connect and Telenav Track, a cell phone-based GPS navigation and tracking service. This powerful combo of technologies allows the agency to do its job effectively during an emergency by supporting quick deployment and effective management of its critical resources. The ability to set up anywhere and at any time is crucial for FEMA, especially when the agency is called upon to provide disaster support. Ha, ha, ha. Sprint offers the following hurricane preparedness tips, pandemic flu tips for businesses and consumers. To learn more, hit the link to watch a Sprint executive speaking about Sprint's pandemic planning and preparation tips for businesses and general consumers. Should we listen to Sprint for our pandemic flu planning tips? We know, of course, that organizations such as these, not to mention all of the telecom immunity and spying they're involved in with the NSA and the previous and current presidential puppets, these guys are a part of what's called a critical infrastructure. And thanks to Matt Rothschild of the Progressive, he broke open the inside story on what is known as InfraGuard. And that is essentially deputizing those in the private sector, those connected with critical infrastructure, that they essentially have shoot-to-kill orders should the shit hit the fan. So here we have another case of the telecoms in bed with the state. Sprint providing cell and global positioning systems to FEMA for their vehicle tracking program. We first had an article from the Washington Times, and we'll flesh it out with a few other bits of headlines. Killer McChrystal warns more troops or mission failure in our Afghan surge, or the right war, if we like to quote Obama. General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. and NATO commander in Afghanistan, said in a confidential report that without additional forces, the war against insurgents there will end in failure, the Washington Post reported Monday. McChrystal's grim assessment of the war was published on the Post website, with some portions withheld at the government's request. Quote, although considerable effort and sacrifice have resulted in some progress, many indicators suggest the overall effort is deteriorating, McChrystal wrote in his summary. The report was sent to Defense Secretary Robert Gates in August and is now under review by Obama, who's trying to decide whether to send more U.S. troops to the Afghan surge. The meat grinder. The right war. The place we were already amassing ships near pre-9/11. That's a documented fact. It's all about the pipelines and the terror juice, kids. More on this from the Washington Post. And you can read more about McChrystal on historycommons.org, running down his lowlights of recent months. So, was this a leaked report, quote-unquote? Of course, it's always interesting when leaked military and governmental reports go to the Washington Post, referred to by some as the CIA's favorite newspaper. So, are they leaking, supposedly, this is some kind of trial balloon? Probably. So, this segues into the list of ugly headlines. War whores, spy surge, drones, dirigibles, and future wars. First up, another question from Global Research. What can Americans do to oppose the warfare state? This is an article by Sherwood Ross, who notes right at the top that Americans who voted for peace last November but are only getting more war are becoming increasingly disillusioned. The majority of Americans, polls show, would slash the military budget by over 30%, yet Obama has increased it by 4%. Change. That's some change. A majority of Americans want U.S. troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan, but the Pentagon will garrison 50,000 in the former country indefinitely and dispatch perhaps 20,000 more shortly to escalate the war in the latter. That being Afghanisurge. Since voting doesn't bring the desired change in national policies, people wonder what they can do individually. The answer is quite a lot. Breaks down the list of local organizations, which that's maybe essentially the thing to take home. Your home. Your community. That's what you can do. Be involved. Meet people. Talk. Spread information, spread ideas. You don't want the first time to meet your neighbors when suddenly nothing works. Military growing impatient with Obama on Afghanistan. That's from McClatchy. And it's those kind of interesting things that, again, to the well-meaning left would say, yeah, the military's getting impatient because all they want to do is kill. And Obama, he's so peaceful. You know, he's just jerking them around. CIA launching spy surge into Afghanistan. This by way of the Los Angeles Times. The CIA deploying teams of spies, analysts, and paramilitary operatives to Afghanistan, part of an intelligence surge that will make the agency station there among the largest in CIA history. When complete, the Cocaine Importation Agency, or the Criminals in Action, their presence in the country is expected to rival the size of its massive stations in Iraq and Vietnam at the height of those fantastic wars. Precise numbers are, of course, classified, but one U.S. official said the CIA already has nearly 700 employees in Afghanistan. I believe we're supposed to hear more from Killer McChrystal today on his troop boost. If we hit dodbuzz.com, the long-expected request for more troops from McChrystal will come within the next 2 days, that being right now. New Yorker goes more into reading the McChrystal report. Interesting times indeed. And the Air Force crashed an out-of-control drone in Afghanistan. That's by way of Escapist magazine. Danger Room goes into Bob Gates' supposed overhaul of the Pentagon. Again, Bob Gates was George W. Bush's head of the military. He's still Obama's head of the military. That should tell you something. Again, don't listen to what they say. Look at what they do. Science behind U.S. coercive interrogations missing in action. This from ArsTechnica.com, of course, essentially pointing out that the supposed science and proof behind torture is that it gets information, which, of course, it does not. U.S. to deploy optionally manned hover dirigible in 2011. That's from the Register. Army wants ideas on future wars, again from dodbuzz.com. You always got to have a new idea of what, you know, what new product you're going to roll out. We need some ideas on some future wars. What are some theaters of operation we haven't looked at? Discover magazine goes into smart guns that read your DNA, which of course references the fantastic film District 9. Our fine friends in the private military contracting crews, Science Applications International, SAIC, they have moved their corporate headquarters to one of the main spookvilles on the East Coast. That's McLean, Virginia. Fleshing it out even further by way of Alex Constantine is the untold story of SAIC, Network Solutions, and the rise of the web. And that's War Horrors, Spy Surge, Drones, Dirigibles, and Future Wars. We just referenced District 9. There have been a lot of interesting films. Again, we sometimes note that isn't it fascinating that the news, which is supposed to tell us the truth, tells us a bunch of lies, and the movies, which is supposed to tell us stories and make-believe, actually tell a lot of truth. So we've covered many things in recent months, movies that have come out or are about to come out, such as Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island, which is essentially going to be about CIA, MK Ultra mind control. We had Carriers, a poorly received pandemic virus horror teen flick. But coming soon, from John Ronson's book, his non-fiction book has been turned into a fiction film of the same name. And what is that name? The Men Who Stare at Goats. In this quirky, dark comedy inspired by a real-life story you'll hardly believe is actually true, astonishing revelations about a top-secret wing of the U.S. military comes to light when a reporter encounters an enigmatic special forces operator on a mind-boggling mission. Reporter Bob Wilton, played by Ewan McGregor, is in search of his next big story when he encounters Lynn Cassidy, George Clooney, a shadowy figure who claims to be a part of an experimental U.S. military unit. According to Cassidy, the New Earth Army is changing the way wars are fought. A legion of warrior monks with unparalleled psychic powers can read the enemy's thoughts, pass through solid walls, and even kill a goat simply by staring at it. Now, the program's founder, Bill Django, played by Jeff Bridges, has gone missing, and Cassidy's mission is to find him. Intrigued by his new acquaintance's far-fetched stories, Bob, our reporter, our hero, Ewan McGregor, impulsively decides to accompany him on the search. When the pair tracks Django to a clandestine training camp run by renegade psychic Larry Hooper, played by Kevin Spacey, Freemason and Oscar winner, the reporter is trapped in the middle of a grudge match between the forces of Django's New Earth Army and Hooper's personal militia of super soldiers. In order to survive this wild adventure, Bob will have to outwit an enemy he never thought possible. The Men Who Stare at Goats was inspired by John Ronson's nonfiction bestseller of the same name, an eye-opening and often hilarious exploration of the government's attempts to harness paranormal abilities to combat its enemies.
My name is Bob Wilton. I'm a journalist. I've been investigating a story about a classified government program. So, what you're saying is that you were a psychic spy?
A Jedi warrior.
I'd heard that the U.S. government was training psychic soldiers, and that Lynn Cassidy was the best of the best.
I've been reactivated. I'm on a mission.
I could come. Lynn's story was unbelievable, crazy, and completely true.
You have to dream a new America that no longer has an exploitative view of everyone. You will be a psychic weapon. Feel it, yeah! You must create warrior monks who can pass through walls and see into the future.
Congratulations, Scotty. Sorry it doesn't work out between you two.
What are you doing?
Cloudberries. Keeps me in shape. And it's gone.
Jeez, you had like a whole desert to drive in, Lynn.
Please, please. Thank you for picking us up.
How are we going to stop them? They've got guns.
We're Jedi. We don't fight with guns. We fight with our minds.
Holy.
I went looking for a story, and my friend Lynn brought me an adventure.
It's okay, we're Americans. We're here to help you.
What happened?
I think I just ran him over.
Oh, crap.
Lieutenant Colonel Django used funds from the project's black budget to procure prostitutes.
That's a lie.
And to get drugs for himself and his men.
That... Well, the hooker thing is definitely a lie.
I do find it fascinating that George Clooney, whenever he's involved in films that he has had something to do with the production or even directing, it always seems to have something to do with CIA, like Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. And I'm sure there's others that I'm forgetting off the top of my head. But this is another example of a film that purports to give you a meal, but it's only some crumbs. Go to the source text if you want to actually find out more. And again, I'm not saying the movie should be more than it is. It is a movie, but don't take it for reality. These things are real, but it's being spun in a funny way. It's like the film The Good Shepherd, which I referenced many, many times. Conflating stories, mixing it all up, and you're thinking you're getting the real inside scoop into the CIA and Skull and Bones. A related update to this story on the Men Who Stare at Goats comes from Time Magazine. However, and they make no reference to the film within the article. I thought for sure this would be a nice little tie-in, and then wouldn't be surprised if the movie had something to do with Warner Brothers and Warner and Time, and they write articles about movies that are coming out. Samurai Mind Training for American Modern Warriors. Samurai Mind Training. Now, posted last Saturday And this was in the lead-up to all the great international conferences and conflagrations that we've seen in the past week. Posted last Saturday, the 19th of September 2009, by way of the Los Angeles Times, Obama to hold September 22nd talks with Israel and Palestine in New York. Palestinian and Israeli leaders have agreed to meet with Obama Tuesday in New York, a three-way encounter the administration has been trying for weeks to broker, the White House announced Saturday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas will meet Obama on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly session. White House Press Secretary and frontman liar Robert Gibbs said in a statement. And then each also get a one-on-one with Obama. So again, we have a three-way and then some one-on-one. It wasn't clear whether scheduling of the meetings portends a full-scale resumption of Middle East peace negotiations. White House officials had avoided setting preconditions for a three-way meeting, but did not want to hold one without some promise of progress. There was no sign of a breakthrough when Obama's Middle East envoy, George J. Mitchell, returned to the United States last Friday, again, the 18th. He returned to the U.S. after 6 days of talks. Mitchell's been trying for months to bring the two sides together. A key obstacle is growth of Jewish settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, territory the Palestinians want for a future state. But they didn't have a Balfour Declaration signed on September 11th, 1922, I believe. Setting the precedent, setting the ground for an Israeli state. The envoy failed to persuade Netanyahu to impose a settlement freeze or coax Abbas to restart peace talks without one. Saturday's White House statement said the meetings this week will continue the administration's efforts, quote, to lay the groundwork for the relaunch of negotiations and to create a positive context for those negotiations. There's more in there. Again, as always, thanks to historycommons.org. You can read more about Netanyahu and George Mitchell by way of Wikipedia, and there's more from Time Magazine and Politico and on and on. Interestingly enough, and this, of course, sets us up to jump to the latest geopolitical updates, ZBIG, United Nations, and Global Government. By way of ABC News... Fascinating. Zbigniew Brzezinski in the grand chessboard. Now, recall, Zbigniew Brzezinski was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. He is Barack Obama's one of his chief advisors. He, of course, also helped set up the Trilateral Commission, putting him in bed with folks like Poppy Bush, and again, these supposed ideological differences. He also wrote a book called The Grand Chessboard that you should probably check out. Zbigniew Brzezinski, and of course, this, it all keeps spilling out. You know, his daughter acts like an impartial newsreader on the Microsoft General Electric Network, MSNBC, and he has two sons, and they're involved in governmental, private sector, revolving doors. But what's the thing? What did he say? What's the big deal? Zbigniew Brzezinski says that the Obama administration should tell the U.S., or rather, should tell Israel, that the U.S. will attack Israeli jets if they try to attack Iran. The National Security Advisor for former President Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski, gave an interview to thedailybeast.com in which he suggested Obama should make it clear to Israel that if they attempt to attack Iran's nuclear weapons sites, the U.S. Air Force will stop them. Quote, "We're not exactly impotent little babies. They have to fly over our airspace in Iraq. Are we just going to sit there and watch? We have to be serious about denying them that right. That means a denial where you aren't just saying it. If they fly over, you go up and confront them. They have the choice of turning back or not. No one wishes for this, but it could be a liberty in reverse. The USS Liberty was a U.S. Navy technical research ship that the Israeli Air Force mistakenly attacked during the Six-Day War in 1967. Mistakenly is a load of garbage. It's been well documented. It's a classic false flag operation. Israel hit the U.S. to try and blame it on Egypt. That was one of their big enemies at the time. But breaking it down further, by way of war in Iraq, that's iraq-war.ru, but posted up on the fantastic blacklistednews.com, the elites are at war. And again, this shines light on the idea that don't necessarily believe that it's just those 12 Illuminati bloodlines and they control everything and there's no moving any of it. It's not a perfect system. We kind of think of them as either multi-generational serial killers, as Richard Grove has said. You can also think of them as gangsters and gamblers and banksters who can sometimes buy their way up to the table. When you think of relatively new money with folks like Bill Gates, but of course his dad was on the board of Planned Parenthood, of course founded by Margaret Sanger, founder, progenitor of eugenics, given awards by Adolf Hitler. He wrote glowingly of her. That's the thing, the whole eugenics racial cleansing idea. Hitler and the Nazis didn't think of it. They learned it from the Western eugenicists like Margaret Sanger and all your favorite folks like the Huxleys and the Wedgwoods, and the Galtons, and the Darwins. In a shocking development with major geopolitical implications, former National Security Advisor and current man on point for the Western imperialists, Zbigniew Brzezinski, has publicly stated that the United States Air Force will confront any Israeli fighter jets flying over Iraq if Israel attempts to attack Iran. Liberty in reverse, he said. That's an incredible thing for Brzezinski to say. Israel in 1967 attacked the USS Liberty and claimed it was an accident. Pay close attention to how the Israeli media responds to this particular statement from Brzezinski. They say how all of the commissions found it was accidental or mistaken identity. Brzezinski's return to the imperialist forefront after the establishment fully realized that the program of the neocon strategists was so disastrous. That's why the NIE in 07 reported that Iran did not have a nuclear weapons program, a direct result of Brzezinski's influence. This article goes on, and it's very important. Are the elites at war? Are they nervous? Are they seeing the sight of angry citizen pitchforks and torches in the internet community and 9/11 truth and the peace movements coming up over the hillside? Is that causing mad elitist panic? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I'd like to think that it is. U.S. ships arrive ahead of joint missile defense drill in Israel. This from the Jerusalem Post. This drill is called Juniper Cobra. It's going to take place in October. And further info on that story and those military drills, the U.S., you know, they might leave behind some of their weapon systems in Israel after the drill is like, here you go, thanks. Because we don't give you billions enough every year and all kinds of weapons. The U.S. and France both walked out during Ahmadinejad's U.N. speech. That's from the Sydney Morning Herald. The Security Council adopted a nuclear weapons resolution where, again, all our world misleaders grandstand and act like they're not going to have nuclear weapons. They just want to decide who gets to have nuclear weapons. Global government got another facelift. You know, they've had folks like Angelina Jolie and Michael Douglas as part of the UN and the Council on Foreign Relations. It's now supermodel Giselle. She's now a UNEP ambassador. So global government gets a nice little facelift. The Brazilian-born Giselle Bundchen will be one of the most recognized top models of all time. She was designated a Goodwill Ambassador for the United Nations Environment Program. Let's see if she tries to push sterilization and vaccines to the third world to help the environment. Even though most studies show that if you'd actually let developing countries develop, their birth rates would stabilize anyway. But then they would be a threat to the grand chessboard. India to hold joint military exercise with China in 2010. Honduras's Manuel Zelaya sneaks back into the country. That's from the LA Times and from The Guardian. Honduran forces establish perimeter around Brazilian embassy. That's from The Guardian. We've also got from McClatchy. Deposed Honduran leader says mercenaries are out to kill him. And the last note on the recent Honduran coup, by way of the Miami Herald, they're torturing me, Honduras' Manuel Zelaya claims. What does he claim specifically? That Israeli mercenaries are using high-frequency radiation and toxic gases against him. You recall, just a month or so ago, we covered the recent Honduran coup that it was uncovered was pulled off in no small part by military guerrillas trained at what was formerly known as the School of Americas. It's the School of the Assassins, Fort Benning, Georgia. It's where we train third world Latin American military and gangsters to go out and overthrow countries that basically aren't paying up their part. The update on this geopolitics posting, ZBIG, United Nations and Global Government, is the update of, gasp, Iran has a secret nuke plant. Which again, if we glance at Google News right now, top of the page from Fox News, Iran nuclear site could pose a test to U.S. and Israel ties. They are still, of course, touting the New World Economic Order takes shape at G20 article, also on the top of Google News. So, the UN General Assembly, speaking there, in addition to, of course, Obama and Ahmadinejad speaking, Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi used his long, somewhat rambling speech from loose-leaf pages of notes to call for an investigation into the assassinations of JFK and MLK.
Then you should also open the investigations of the file of assassinations, apart from the war files. Once a new, who killed Patrice Lumumba? Why? We just want to record it in our African annals and African history. We want to know how an African liberator, how an African leader, that he was killed, he was assassinated, who killed him? Even for our sons to read history, that our Patrice Lumumba, the leader, the hero of the struggle of Angola, the liberation struggle, that he was assassinated, that he was killed. We want to know the fact about that. Even after 50 years, maybe, this is one file, one dossier should be reopened again. And who killed the Secretary General Hammarskjöld? Who bombed the airplane of this Secretary General in 62 or 61? How come that the airplane of the Security, that the General Assembly, of that the Secretary General of the United Nations, his airplane was bombed? And then the assassination or the killing of Kennedy in 63 or 62, the President of the United States of America. Why? We want to know who killed him. Somebody who by the name of Lee Harvey, and then another Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey. Why did he kill him? Jack Ruby, an Israeli, killed Lee Harvey, who killed Kennedy. Why did this Israeli kill the killer of Kennedy? Then the killer of Jack Ruby, the killer of Kennedy, died ambiguously and mysteriously. We don't know before the trial. We have to open the files. The whole world should be We know, and we read it, that Kennedy wanted to investigate the finds of the nuclear reactor of the Israeli demand, and then it is to do with the Security Council, it is to do with the peace and security of the world, and then we should open this file. Why? And then the killing of Martin Luther King, Black River, who a human rights activist, his killing was a plot, and we should know why he was killed and who killed him. And then Khalid al-Wazir, Abu Jihad, the Palestinian, and he was attacked. He was in Tunisia, living peacefully there, and the independence of this country was not respected. We cannot keep it quiet. So even though submarines and ships came along the shores of Tunisia, and he was killed there, and then no one is blamed and no one is judged for that. And then Abu Iyad also was killed, and we should know how he was killed. He was killed in ambiguous circumstances. And Ferdan or the youth founder. In this operation, Kamal Nasser is a poet, Kamal Adwan, and Abu Yusuf al-Najjar, three Palestinians, were killed in a country that is sovereign, member states and security councils, member general assembly in Lebanon. They were living or sleeping peacefully. They were attacked and assassinated. We should know who killed them, and we should judge so that these violations of mankind should not be repeated.
I find it quite fascinating that Muammar Gaddafi used his return to the public stage to talk about the laundry list he just went through in that just a little 3.5 minute clip of his long rambling speech that is probably easier to deal with a transcript, but that he would use that opportunity to run down the list of all the mysterious assassinations both in the U.S. and around the world over the last several decades. So that's a positive thing. Quickly, now, other good news. Neocon godfather and Trotskyite Irving Kristol, dead at the age of 89.
The man often called the father of neoconservatism has died. Irving Kristol was an author and columnist and magazine editor who described himself as an ex-liberal who'd been mugged by reality. His son Bill Kristol, also a well-known conservative editor and writer, said his father died of complications from lung cancer. Irving Kristol was 89 years old.
We've pretty much run out of time. I can't fully go into Irving Kristol. And he was, of course, a follower of the Russian communist Leon Trotsky. While Irving Kristol was going to college in New York in the 30s, he then became a lefty. He then became a neocon. Again, these guys lick their finger and see which way the winds are going to blow. For the best breakdown that's easy to handle, comes from part one of Adam Curtis's three-part documentary, The Power of Nightmares. The first installment is called Baby, It's Cold Outside, and it goes into what essentially is the shadows cast on the wall by all these supposed international terrorists. Power of Nightmares breaks down where the ideologies come from and who pushes them and why. Power of Nightmares. Lastly, on this 142nd episode of MediaMonarchy.com, futurist Alvin Toffler discusses third wave, that is, post-industrial life. More fine work from RussiaToday.com. Celebrated futurist Alvin Toffler has forecasted death and bankruptcy to the existing organizational institutes. It's about an 11-minute clip. Let's just get a little bit where futurist and author Alvin Toffler elaborates on this and other predictions on where society is heading.
You talk about transition, that we're going to be transiting from industrialized era to a super industrialized era.
Well, I wouldn't call it super industrial. We call it a third wave.
Third wave. Yeah. What are the principal differences between
the difference
those two
is
eras?
That an industrialized country or community, we all know what that is. It involves repetitiveness in production and so forth and so on. I believe that the third wave, which is now beginning to appear in more and more countries or aspects of countries, is one that is increasingly dependent on knowledge and technologies based on sophisticated knowledge, and that we should think about the future, as I say, not just as an extension of the present. Typically, people say it's more of the same. Whatever's happening now will just happen more. It'll be faster, it'll be slower, it'll be this or that. But that's a very simplistic way to think about the future. The future will have surprises in it. And it will have events that will alter the lifestyle of millions and millions of people, because there will be new opportunities, there will be new foods, there will be new mechanisms, there will be new everything out there. And when you put some of those together, they begin to make possible all kinds of changes. And I believe that we are at the edge of moving beyond the industrial age, which was in fact one in which we saw continual repetition, into what we call third wave, which will be full of surprises for us.
Now, what will happen to the existing institutions in this kind of society?
Well, I think that the nature of our institutions is, in fact, a perfect example of what we call second wave or linear operations. And I think this is going to lead to tremendous changes that companies and organizations that continue to try to function in a straight line from what they've been doing for the past 10, 20 years are going to die, or they will be bankrupted, and that we will find new kinds of organizational arrangements. We may have temporary units instead of having a fixed unit. We may have temporary units connected to foreign units or all kinds of other things. And the technologies themselves will require different levels of and types of education and experience.
Do you think technologies threaten humans as individuals?
People using technology may threaten people. The technologies themselves, I don't think, are necessarily have to be evil or that they threaten. An automobile threatens people with hitting them on a highway. But it's the driver who really matters. And I think the same thing is true here. It's not that the technologies, we may create technologies that are dangerous, that put out issue a poison to the community. That's possible. But that's not the technology. It's the people who made it that way.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was just a quick clip from Russia Today's interview with author and futurist Alvin Toffler. He's written books called The Third Wave. But he also has a book called Future Shock. And I remember quite well, early on in college, in the English building, I believe, you know, there are always, every now and then, boxes of random books and textbooks and things that you can grab for free. There was a beat-up paper book copy of Future Shock by Alvin Toffler. What I did not know, in doing a little bit of research on that and just adding some of the supplemental links to flesh it out for you, there's a documentary from 1972 based on the book Future Shock by Alvin Toffler, and it's narrated by one of my artistic heroes, Orson Welles. Future shock is a sickness that comes from too much change in too short a time. It's the feeling that nothing's permanent anymore. It's the reaction to changes that happen so fast we can't absorb them. It's the premature arrival of the future. And for those who are unprepared, its effects can be pretty devastating.
May I have your attention, please? Flight number 341 will be arriving at gate 7.
In the course of my work, which takes located just about every corner of the globe. I see many aspects of a phenomenon which I'm just beginning to understand. Our modern technology has achieved a degree of sophistication beyond our wildest dreams, but this technology has exacted a pretty heavy price. We live in an age of anxiety, a time of stress, and with all our sophistication, we are, in fact, the victims of our own technological strength. We are the victims of shock, of future shock.
And so, yes, Orson Welles has the last word from the 1972 documentary that's actually available in its entirety up on YouTube. I posted up the playlist, Future Shock, and that's where we're going to leave it for episode 142 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's September 25th, 2009. A quick glance at a short list of creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. You know, if you put a little stat counter on your website that shows how many hits you get, it gives you the back-end login to see who's visiting your website. And when you traffic in the kind of information that MediaMonarchy.com does, you'll get visits like this. The United States Naval Academy out of Annapolis, Maryland. The USCourts.gov out of Washington, D.C. They Googled McChrystal failure. The U.S. General Accounting Office out of Upper Marlboro, Maryland. They Googled Ardent Century. The recent military terror drill we went over extensively on Media Monarchy. Nonetheless, was my interview with Clyde Lewis. The U.S. Army headquarters out of Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And finally, the United States Postal Service out of Raleigh, North Carolina. Now, that's a short list, but interestingly enough, overall general traffic to the website has been up and up and up. Slowly but surely. Again, thanks in no small part to my recent interview with Richard Grove. That's still available. It's up at the top of the page. Don't miss the interview with Richard Grove of TragedyAndHope.com. Again, we're planting seeds. We're giving you information. We're trying to empower you so you can make better decisions. My friends, if you'd like the show, please spread the word. Drop me a line. Facebook, MySpace, Twitter Tube, Yahoo, Gmail, Skype, Instant Messenger. Any number of ways we can make contact and spread the word. This has been episode 142 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's September 25th, 2009. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the sites and show, MediaMonarchy.com, FoodWorldOrder.com, and CyberspaceWar.com, reminding you to get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.